So I'm going to temporarily put everybody on mute just to kind of start off, and then people can unmute themselves to chime in and participate as they wish. Do believe that's second. Okay. I don't know if you can still hear me. When I jump to share screen, sometimes my computer freezes. I'm not sure why. Okay. There you go. Unfrozen. Was it frozen for everybody else or just for me? Just for me?
It's fine.
Wherever I'm happy if my computer turns on.
All right, we'll be okay. We're just going to set something up very briefly. Okay. We were at the very tail end of this parak, and the last thing we had done at the end of a discussion last week was looked at the language of David's tefillah, suggesting from a lot of different references here, but in particular this pasuk Chaf Gimel, which is so confusing. It's got phrases that are out of place. The language, the syntax, this is a kind of a hodgepodge of phrases that we can make heads or tails out of somehow, but the language is very awkward. Mikem Chai Yisrael Goyachad Ba'aretz. Asher hachu Elokim lifdot lo la'am v'lasum lo shem v'lasot lachem hagdula v'noraot le'artzecha mipnei amacha asher patita lacha mimitzrayim goyim ve'elokav. On so many fronts, form of speech, who is he speaking to? Is he speaking to God? Is he speaking to Israel? Second person, third person, reference to nations and gods in redemption. It's a complex series of phrases. We kind of offered various interpretations, but in the end, we're left with a mystery as to the language. And I suggested, based on other examples as well, that there are certain times in Tanakh where you can hear or feel the emotion of the speaker by virtue of the language and its Dafka, its lack of cohesiveness, meaning the way we speak when we're emotional is not necessarily in clear, articulate sentences. In general, when we speak rather than when we write, we kind of speak without necessarily thinking about sentence and grammar structure, etc. We kind of just casually, if you take a person's sentences, you see this a lot in email, where people dictate. In text messages where people dictate, and you hear language that's not cohesive sentences, and you're reading things that are not necessarily syntactically consistent because we're just speaking, and half sentences come out, and then we shift gears and we go to other half sentences, and that's the way we speak. So when we dictate, that's the way it comes out. Normally, when we write, we review and we're careful and we go over it, we proof it, etc. And sometimes you'll still get typos, but at the end, it's generally a different style than when we speak extemporaneously, and certainly when we speak emotionally. And emotion is something which, in general, is very rare in Tanakh. I don't know if we've ever had the chance to address this, but very rarely does the Tanakh reflect people's emotional state of being. It's very rare for Tanakh to address or to mention what people are feeling or what people are thinking. It's just not the norm of the sort of the language of Tanakh. One of the most famous examples of this is Abraham going to the Akedah, where in the text it says there's 3 days between the time he leaves and the time he arrives at Har Moriah, but there's literally nothing in the text of what happens during those 3 days. And we can conjure in our minds, we can imagine, we can think, and the Medrash will fill in that blank and does try to embellish and imbue the story with some emotion and feeling, But in the language of Tanakh, we're just told, God told him to do this, he did that, he came here, and we're told that the events without necessarily the emotion of it. It's very rare that Tanakh will reflect a kind of emotional state of being, usually when it's particularly relevant to the story, like we had by Yonatan and David, where it talked about their love, or Michal and David, where it talked about their relationship, how Michal loved David, and that plays out in various parts of the story. There are instances, however, where that emotion comes out, not in the way in which Tanakh describes the emotion, but by preserving the language of the speaker. And this is one of those examples where I think you see David is certainly very emotional here, in the emotional context we talked about last week. It's the first time that anybody's ever been given such a promise of eternal leadership from Israel. He'll address that piece of it in the second half of the bracha of his tefillah. But certainly the emotion, I think, is understandable. What I said to you at the end of the shiur was that I was going to give you a couple of examples. Because from one example, you can't really build a pattern. There are two or three very famous examples. One of them we haven't learned yet, so we'll get to it. That's later. It's a story of what's referred to as the Isha Tkuit. It's in Perek Yudalid. We'll come to it a little bit later. The other two examples I want to show you are also in Sefer Shmuel. That's not necessarily intentional, meaning the four examples that we have are in Sefer Shmuel. There are other examples. There's an example in Sefer Shoftim. But for us right now, we're learning Sefer Shmuel. I think it's easiest to just kind of stay in the in this area. So I'll show you two places in Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph in particular, that we learned way back when, where you see this kind of emotional impact influencing the way in which the text comes across. That's going to start from Perek Tet. It's not exactly the same example, but it's a fun example. Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet is one of the most beautiful prakim in Sefer Shmuel. It's the moment where Shaul comes and first meets Shmuel. If you remember the story, Shaul is a young shepherd. His father's donkey's gotten lost, and Shaul goes looking for it together with his na'ar, and ends up encountering Shmuel, who says to him, "Oh, God has designated you to be the first king of Israel." So it's a very powerful, very beautiful parak. But it also introduces us to the context of Shaul, the notion that Shaul was very handsome, very tall. Shaul, Bachur Vatov, young, goodly, looking, handsome, strong, Ein ish mibnei Yisrael tov mimenu, nobody more handsome than he, Mishichmo v'mala gavo mikol ha'am, tall, upwards, head and shoulders above the crowd, right? Which is actually where the phrase comes from. The sort of description of Shaul in this very majestic-looking individual. And then the contrast, Vatavadna ha'atonot, right? He lost his father's donkeys, and he's going to look for them. He's now searching, and he comes to this moment where he's ready to give up. Shaul amar l'naro, she'emo l'cha v'nashuva pen yechdal avi min ha'atonot v'da'ag lanu. Let's go home. Our father might be more concerned about us than about the donkey. Vayomar lo, so the Na'ar says to him, "Wait a second, Hinena Isha Lokim Ba'ir Azot. I heard that there's a Navi, there's an Isha Lokim, a man of God in this city. Mishnichbad, Koloshiyat Bebo Yavo, it's a person who can tell us things. Nachashem Ulaya Gilanu et Darkeinu Ashalachnu Ala, let's go and ask him, maybe he can tell us where these donkeys are." So, in fact, that's what they do. They go, Nelech. The whole discussion about how to pay the Navi, so they find a quarter. Okay, they'll give him a quarter. It's a very naive kind of conversation. All right. Vayomer Shaul naro tov dvarecha lechav nelecha. So Shaul agrees. Vayachur al ha'ir ha'shem ish elokim. Heimo olim b'male ha'ir. They come up to the ascent to the city. Vehemu matzu na'arot yotzot lishov mayim. And standing outside of the city are the maidens who have gone out to draw water from the well. Vayamru lahen. So they answered, Hayesh bazeh. They asked, Hayesh bazeh haro'eh. Have you seen the seer, the Navi? Have you seen where we can find him? So the next two psukim are really what I wanted to focus on, which was the answer of the banot, the answer of these maidens, the na'arot, to Shaul and his na'a. And the backdrop of the introduction that I shared with you is to how the text describes Shaul. Vata'anena otam vatomarna. They answered and said. So here's the answer. Yesh. Yes. Hinei lefanecha. He's in front of you. Maher, quickly. Ata, now. Ki ayom balair. For today he's come to the city. Ki zevach hayom la'am babama. For the people are offering a sacrifice on the high place. Kivuachem ha'ir ken timtzu unato. When you come to the city, that's where you'll find him. Beterem yalea bamata le'echol, before he goes up to the high place, to the altar, to eat. Ki lo yochal ha'am ad bo'o, because the people can't eat until he comes. Ki hu yivarech ha'zevach, he has to make the bracha, like he has to make hamotzi for everybody. Right, he has to make the bracha over the zevach. Achrechen yochlu akwim, and then everybody can eat. V'ata alu, now quickly go. Ki oto ki ayom yimtimtzunato, for today you will find at this time kayom, like at this moment timtzunato, you'll find him. Very nice, very informative, and very wordy.
Could they have been flustered? He was such a good-looking young man.
Oh, so that's my point. Right? So this is that's exactly where my point. Right? If you look at the text by in itself, it's very wordy, and it's very disjointed. They asked one question, which was, "Where can we find Shmuel here? Can we find the Navi?" And what they got was literally a face full of every phrase in the book. Yes, he's here, he's gone up to the sacrifice, they can't eat, they're waiting, he has to come and eat first. Oh, but if you go now quickly, you might catch him. They're all waiting for him to make the offering. That he came today to make the offering, maybe go now, right, by tomorrow at this. Like this disjointed phrases all over the map. So one possibility is that they are flustered. The maidens are out by the well looking to drawing water, and suddenly this very tall, handsome guy walks up and he says to them, excuse me, ladies, where can I find the Ro'eh? And they turn around and their jaw drops. And so they are flustered. What's also possible, and I think it's connected, is that this isn't the response of one person. If this was the response of one person, then it would really be very weird. It would be very strange, because it's so disjointed. But what it reads like, and if you look at the opening pasuk, vata'anena otam, they answered them, vatomarna, and they said, meaning this is the answer of all of them, but they didn't answer in a coordinated effort. Imagine for a moment the scene. Here's the well, or the drop, wherever they're drawing the water from, and the maidens, the na'arot, are all standing around, and up walks this innocent, handsome young shepherd, and they're literally drooling over him, you'll pardon the expression, and they're kind of, each one wants a piece of him, each one wants a piece of the conversation. So you can imagine for a second 15 people, each one wants to have a chance to have a moment to speak to Shaul. So the first one says, Yesh, yes, he's there. And the next one says, Hinei lefanecha, he's over in the next hill. And the next one says, Maher, quickly, Ata, go now. The next one says, Ki ayom balair, he just came yesterday. The next one says, oh, there's a big offering, there's a big celebration in the city, Ki zevach hayom la'am babama, which was not part of the conversation at all, right? And then the next one pushes in and says, oh, when you come to the city, you'll find him. Everyone wants to answer his question. But each one has to offer a little bit of information that's either repetitive or slightly different than the next one. But in the end of the day, this isn't one conversation. This is very disjointed, very energetic, very energized by the presence of Shaul, who they are looking at, staring at, talking to, first time we are introduced to Shaul and the magnetic personality that he has. And so you get this kind of disjointed moment. Now, in this kind of case, it's almost humorous, but the whole parak is humorous. But it's an example, I think, of that kind of emotion that lends itself to disjointed phrases and conversations. In this case, it's because I think it's multiple people. But I think the example is the same idea. A much more dramatic, or I should say almost tragic example of this kind of emotion coming out in the sentences of the speaker. Everybody understand this example? I'm going to leave this for a moment. We're going to jump to Perek Yudbet. Shmuel Aleph Perek Yudbet. Now Shmuel Aleph Perek Yudbet is the other side of the coin, the other extreme. It's Shmuel chastising the people for their chait of having wanted a king in the first place for all the wrong reasons. And so even though Shaul was the right choice, the very choice that they had made was the desire was something which Shmuel was very uncomfortable with, especially because it came at the attack on Shmuel's own integrity and the integrity of his children. So Shmuel has a very emotional investment in this problem. So Shmuel Aleph Perek Yudbet is Shmuel's speech to the people, his last real speech as the leader of Israel, because they've anointed this new king called Shaul, and he's sort of handing the reins over to Shaul. And so Shmuel gathers them all together, and one last moment where he criticizes them, and he says to them, behold, I've Shmati b'kolechem, I've listened to you what you've asked for. Amlich alechem melech, I brought you a king. Here's your king. And then he says to them, this was a very personal attack. They came to him and they said, your children don't go and follow in your footsteps. Your children are perverting justice. They're corrupt. And so Shmuel says to them, hinini anuvi, answer me, neged Hashem and neged Mashicho, before me and before God. And before God and before His Anointed One, et shor mi lakachti, v'chamor mi lakachti, v'et mi eshakti, v'et mi ratzoti, u'miad mi lakachti kofer, ve'li menaybo. Whom have I oppressed? Who have I stolen from? Whose donkey did I take? Whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Have I mistreated any of you? You have rejected me and asked for a king. They were shocked. They said, you, Shmuel, have been the Navi. You've led us loyally and so beautifully. Then he forces them to swear. They do so. Eid Hashem b'chem. Vayomu Shmuel ala'am. So Shmuel says to the people, Hashem asher asad Shmoshe v'et Aaron v'asher ala etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim. God who made Moshe and Aaron and who brought you out of Egypt. Now therefore stand and I will judge you before God. So this is the first instance that there's a indication that Shmuel is getting emotional. What does that mean? God who made Moshe and Aaron, who sent Moshe and Aaron to redeem you out of Egypt. What do you mean, Asad Moshe and Aaron? He made Moshe and Aaron. He sent Moshe and Aaron to take you out of Egypt. Okay. So now, therefore, stand and be judged. And then he gives him a whole history lesson. Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, they cried out, God sent Vayishlach Hashem at Moshe et Aaron, he sent them messengers, he sent them Nevi'im, the Nevi'im took him out of Egypt. Nevi'im, his basic message is Nevi'im were always good enough for you, now suddenly you want a king. And they abandoned God in the course of time, God gave him into the hands of various enemies, Sisra and Melech Moab, etc. And every time they cried out, God brought somebody to help them. Vayizaku el Hashem, chatanu, we've sinned. And they, and God sent them, Vayishlach, not Moshe and Aaron in Mitzrayim, but throughout the years, whenever they were in trouble, God sent them somebody to save them. Yerubal, and Bidan, which is Shimshon, and Yiftach, and Shmuel. And he saved, and through the Shoftim, and through the Nevi'im, they were able to save you. And however, now it's different. Vatiruki Nachash b'nei Amon ba'alechem, suddenly you saw Nachash, king of Ammon, come and attack you. Vatomru lilo, kim malachim lacholeinu. Now suddenly you want a king. Hashem alakechem alakechem. And God is your king. Yadayne ha'melech asher b'chartem asher sh'altem. Here's the king you want. Here's the king you asked for. Hinei natan Hashem alakechem melech. God has given you a king. Now look at the next two psukim carefully. Im tir'u et Hashem, v'avadetem oto ishmatem b'kolo, v'lo tamru et pi Hashem. If you fear God and serve Him and listen to His voice, v'item gam atem megam melech asher malach alechem achar Hashem alekechem, and you and your king who will reign over you will be loyal to God. But if you don't listen to God and rebel against God, then God's hand will be against you and against your forefathers. Those two psukim make any sense? What's wrong with those two psukim?
There's no then, if then.
Right, it's half a conditional statement. If you will hearken to God, if you will hear His voice, if you will not rebel, if you will follow in His footsteps, if you and your king will be loyal to God, but if not, oy vavay lecha. And if yes? Im tiruat Hashem, what happened to the other half of that sentence? So that's exactly the point. If you will follow God, and if you will hearken to His voice, and if you will observe His laws, but if you don't, right, in the emotional moment, you can hear the mind operating faster than the words. And the drop of that half a sentence, because his mind is already racing too, but if not... And the test that he's going to devise to demonstrate to them that the very request that they've made was a mistake, Hashem is going to make a miracle with the water and the fleece and the dry fleece and the we're not going to get into it all, but here already you begin to see that there's the sentence structure begins to break down, and then by the end. And he really is kind of on a roll. And you hear it again. Vayomer Shmuel el ha'am, Al tirau, don't be afraid. Atem asitem et kol hara'a azot. You have done all of this evil. Ach al tasru miachanei Hashem v'avadetem et Hashem b'chol levavchem. Don't abandon God. Serve God with your heart. V'lo tasuru ki acharei atohu. Do not turn aside, because after vanities, because they are vain, and they will not deliver, for they are vain. For God will not abandon His people because of His great name. Because God pleases Him to, it pleases God to have you as His people. I also, far be it from me to sin, to not pray on your behalf, and I will continue to instruct you, b'derech hatova v'yeshara. Ach yiru at Hashem, but fear God and serve Him. Be'emet b'chol levavchem. Ki yira'u at Hashem igdil imachem, for consider how great He has been for you. But if you will do wickedly, then you and your king will be swept away. End of sentence. So again, a jumping from subject to subject, there is no coherent structure to these last psukim. It's a back and forth. Yes, no, be good, be bad, be good, be bad. Right, back and forth. And then you get to these two psukim, Chaf Aleph, and or Chaf Aleph, Chaf Bet. How many times does Shmuel used the word ki. V'lotasuru ki acharei ha-toa shelo ya'ilu v'liat silu. Ki to'o heima. Ki lo yitash Hashem atamo v'avu shmo agadol. Ki yo'il Hashem la'asot etchem lo la'am. Word, always said, don't start a sentence with the word and don't use the word, one word over and over and over again, right? Ki acharei ha-toa. Ki lo yitash, ki to'o. Ki lo yitash Hashem. Ki yo'il Hashem la'asot etchem lo la'am. Look at this phrase for a minute. Lo tasuru ki acharei atohu asher lo ya'ilu v'lo yatzilu ki to'o heima. It's hard to even translate because syntactically this phrase has no meaning. Do not turn aside, lo tasuru ki acharei atohu, for after vanity that will not help, asher lo ya'ilu v'lo yatzilu, and will not save, ki to'o heima, for they are vain. This grammar, v'lo tasuru ki acharei atohu, do not abandon, do not stray, because after vanity, that will not profit or save, because they are vain.
Right, it's, Rabbi, don't you think there's a difference between a written text and a spoken text?
In part, that's my point, except that most texts that are spoken and then written are then edited to be at least understandable. And what I'm, and I think that exact is my point, is that there are certain moments where the emotion of the spoken context is preserved in the way it gets recorded. So here, for example, v'lotosuru ki acharei atohu, read this sentence. If you can understand the Hebrew without the translation, it's easier. But read this sentence without this word ki. V'lotosuru acharei atohu asher lo ya'ilu v'lo yatzilu. Ki to'o heima. Do not stray after the vain and useless things that do not save, because they are vain. Right? That sentence makes sense. But by throwing the word ki into the middle of the phrase, lo tasuru ki acharei atohu, I've confused the whole sentence. But this word ki is now going to appear four times, and so you sort of get the sense that he's on a roll and just threw it into the middle of the sentence structure. All of these, I think, are examples of the same point, which is that the emotion of the speaker here is preserved in a way that takes the spoken text, which sometimes is disjointed and not syntactically accurate. Usually, by the time we write it, we edit it, we fix all the mistakes. Right? I mean, we all do that. We speak when we come to write it down. We write down what we said, but we write it down in a way that is logical and structured and grammatically correct, etc. Here, what you've got is a record of the speech preserved in a way that I think intentionally preserved the emotion of the context rather than just the words.
Hang on
a second, Adina.
Then it's Phyllis too. She wants to ask a question.
Do you think another example of this, or maybe it's something else, and it's so direct, is David's B'ni Avshalom, B'ni Avshalom?
Possibly.
And on, keeps going on.
We haven't gotten there yet, but possibly. For sure.
Feels like that, you know. Right. It preserves the emotion, and it's.
Right. And poetry will do that all the time, and in that regard, yeah. Poetry is a whole different context because it's designed to be repetitive and poetic, and but yeah, for sure. But we haven't gotten to that part of the story yet, so.
My question is about these emotions. Do we ever take into account who wrote all of this? I mean, because you keep talking about emotions, isn't every person who wrote all of this, they all have different kinds of emotions?
Well, the text is written by the Nevi'im, so I'm assuming that the Nevi'im are writing in some, you know, the words are carefully conveyed in a way that is intentional for whatever they're trying to, the message they're trying to give over. Up until the story of, certainly past Amalek, is all written by Shmuel. So Shmuel is the speaker and Shmuel is the author. So, I mean, the example I think is very real life, meaning, I do a lot of speaking and I do a lot of writing. It happens to me all the time. You write and you write and you write, and then you get up to speak and you're extemporaneous and you kind of veer off the page and you get into other things and you say that which is on your mind, and sometimes it's coherent and sometimes the message is coherent, but the sentences are not necessarily so grammatically and syntactically formed. Then the question becomes, do you preserve it the way it was written or the way it was spoken? And that's always the question. I think that's a very real example of this kind of moment.
Because Rabbi, there's nothing worse than somebody just getting up and reading a speech.
Yeah, okay. I hear you. Okay. That is more or less an example that I wanted to share with you. There's a couple of other examples we've seen in the past and we'll get to in the future, but for now, I think the point comes across. So I want to come back to the final piece of this parak, and we'll spend a little bit of time on the end of this parak, and then see where we go from there. So again, this is all back to Perek Zion. This is all David's speech to, or tefillah, I should say, in response to God's promise to David. So the first part of it, Ve'evo Melech, Ve'yeshev Lifnei Hashem, Ve'yom Ami Anochi, this we dealt with last week, his humility, his sense of feeling unworthy, the greatness of God, the greatness of Israel, the redemption of Israel, that was that pasuk that kind of took us on an emotional tangent, and how God had promised Israel that Israel would be God's people for all eternity. That's an old promise, right? That's from the days of Yetziat Mitzrayim. God promised that Israel would be God's people for eternity. But now, God has added something which has not been in the offer before, which is a promise of eternal leadership. That's new. That's a new concept. And so the remainder of this tefillah focuses on the promise that God made to David and the uniqueness of it, to the point where David really is asking God to do whatever he can to preserve it. It's almost as if he knows how extraordinary this request really is and how precarious it is. V'ata Hashem Elokim, hadavar asher dibarta al avdecha ve'al beito, that which you spoke about your servant and his household and his house, his descendants, hakem ad olam, that they would be established for eternity, v'aseh kasher dibarta, do of you as you have spoken. What does it mean, v'aseh kasher dibarta? What God is not going to do as he spoke? What does that mean? V'aseh kasher dibarta. Did David have a hava mina for a moment that God was not going to fulfill this promise. He says, now this that you have spoken to your servant about his descendants, that they would be a Hakem Adolam, establish them for eternity. Asei kasher dibarta, do as you have spoken. Come back to that question. Veigdal shimcha ad olam lemor, let your name be magnified for eternity. Say, Hashem Tzvaot Elokim Yisrael, God of hosts of Israel, ubeit avdecha David yeh nachon lefanecha, let the house of your servant David be established for eternity. That's exactly what God promised him, that his household would be, and his house would be leader, the Melech, for eternity. Ki ata Hashem Tzvaot Elokei Yisrael, you God of hosts of Israel, galita et ozen avdecha lemor, you have revealed to your servant, saying, Bayit evnelach, I will build you a house. Akein matzav dachat libo litpalel alech et ha-tefila zot, that's why I'm offering this tefila. Ata Hashem Elokim, ata hu Elokim, now God, you are God. Udvarcha yu emet, your words are truth. Vatedaber al avdecha hatova zot, you speak to your servant this wonderful promise. Vata ho'el uvarech et bet avdecha, let it please you and bless your house of your servant. Liot le'olam lefanecha, to be eternal before you. Ki ata Hashem Elokim, dibarta, for you God, you have spoken. Umi birchotcha yivarach beit avdecha leolam, from your blessing shall your household of your servant be blessed for eternity. If you had to sum up these five psukim in one phrase, what would it be?
I think David's like in awe. I'm so excited that this promise has been made.
Right. So what is it? So summarize these five psukim in one phrase.
I can't believe my kingship's going to be made into a dynasty forever.
Okay.
Like I won the lottery. I can't see it enough.
Won the lottery, maybe. Okay, good. I think it's summarized in this one phrase right here. Asei kasher dibarta. God, you do as you have promised. His tefillah here, it's a tefillah. 8 times in this phrase, in this paragraph, he acknowledges the blessing and thanks God for the blessing and for this promise of eternity. And davens that would that it be so, that his kingdom should be eternal. Hakem Adolam, Aseka Shedibarta, Beit Avdecha Yenachon Lefanecha, let your household be, my house be established before you. Alken Matzav Dechat Libol, Ata Hashem Elokim, Dvarcha Yu Emet, your words are true. Daber Al Avdecha Tadavazot, you spoke to your servant these words. Ho'el Uvarechet Beit Avdecha, bless your servant's house. Liot Leolam Lefanecha, to be eternal before you. You, God, have spoken this. Ata Hashem dibarta. Your words are true. From your words should come this blessing. It's not for vain. This, every sentence here is about his awe, his surprise, but at the same time, his hope, his tefillah. This is an unprecedented promise that God has made to him. And his whole soul yearns that, would that this be so. Imagine if God came to us and said, I promise you that you will have a descendant sitting on the throne of Israel forever. I mean, it's an extraordinary promise. And so there's an awe and there's a reverence and there's a sense of gratitude that is off the charts, and he expresses it. This is a tefillah, this is hodaya, this is acknowledgement, this is a hope. Would that it be so? There's an element of anticipation there as well, right? Would that it be the case? All of this is reflected in this tefillah. There's one additional element that I think we need to recognize, And then I don't think David would have gone out of his way for five psukim, one, two, three, four, five psukim, that all say the same thing, would that it be so, if he didn't in some way realize that all is not as it seems. I mean, go back to what we had spoken about 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago about the question as to whether or not this promise was absolute or conditional. And we recognize the fact that there's, despite the fact that it's expressed to David in a way that is absolute, eternal, Adolam, how many times has he used the expression Adolam in this tefillah? And yet we knew and we understand that Adolam doesn't mean perpetually, it can mean something else, and that there are times when the reality is not that way. We live today. There's no Malchus Beis David, right? There's no kingdom. There's no king. We don't even know who the descendants of King David are, necessarily. And so I think you sense that David realizes how unique, but almost how absurd this promise is, that no matter what his children do, no matter how grave their sin might be in the future, there will always be an element, a son to sit on the throne. How long can we sustain that kind of it doesn't matter what we do, God promised attitude? Right? It's dangerous. So I think embedded in this
The time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, they thought, no, that couldn't happen. God won't do that. Right. So, right, that was dangerous.
So it is a very dangerous promise, and I think that David senses that it's not all is not what it seems, and maybe it's more conditional than the way it was articulated to him. And so there's this constant tefillah of would that it be the case? Keep your blessing. Your words are true. Dvarcha emet. From your blessing shall your servant's house be blessed. Right? That's not just a description. That's also a tefillah, a hope, that he's articulating from his humility with which the parak, which with the tefillah begins, but also the recognition that this is a bracha and a promise that is A, unprecedented, and B, too good to be true. And if it's too good to be true, something's amiss. And maybe it's not so eternal, and maybe it's not so consistent, and maybe it's more conditional than at first blush. And so all that we had expressed in terms of the fear or the other version of this promise as it merges, as it appears throughout Tanakh, maybe David is sensing some of that ambiguity or ambivalence. And so his emphasis here is the hope that it is more literal than would otherwise be the case. So I think that may also be playing a role in this bracha, which leaves us with one more piece of this puzzle, and really what I'm going to suggest, we're going to actually have to unfortunately have to stop a few minutes early today, but really from here this is really the segue to the next parak, right? We're going to move on to the next parak and we finish parak Zion. But before we do that, I really want to take one more kind of look at the world of David HaMelech and the promise to David and its influence and impact on Jewish life overall beyond the scope of this parak. And you know, this whole promise to David that his household will be eternal, there will always be a melech, and yet the ambiguity, and yet the questions, and yet we read the Perek of Tehillim in which the challenges was articulated, and David feels that that notion is too good to be true, that God will, that this child will always be a child on his throne forever, no matter what he does. This has a very important and very powerful ramification for Jewish theology and Jewish life in general. Right? It's the seat, it's the foundation of what we refer to as the promise of Biyat HaMashiach. We're sitting at one of the most significant concepts in all of Tanakh and all of Jewish thought. The promise that there will be a descendant from the house of David who will come back and lead us. Right? That's what Melech HaMashiach is all about. So it's one of the most dramatic concepts in all of Jewish thought. So what I wanted to do was actually look at the ramification of this particular promise in, and this notion that sort of compromise that we articulated between the promise to David that his household will be eternal and the reality of life in which that eternal promise is somewhat mitigated, and how it plays out in various aspects of David's life, David's descendants' life, and Jewish thought and liturgy overall. David really has become a symbol that is far greater than just the story of David. What's the most famous song in Jewish life today?
David Melech
Chai V'Kayam. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. I would say that's probably the most, probably the most recognized Hebrew Jewish song in the liturgy. Maybe Hava Negila. I was going to say maybe Hava Negila might be, but within the liturgy of Jewish life, let's leave it at that. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. And the story of David is as a symbol, is extraordinary. Here's the promise that he'll have a throne for all eternity. And the fear that eternally is not so eternal. Right? And so we have this promise that even if it's not eternal today, or it's not happening today, it will become eternal again. Right? This notion of Yomot HaMashiach. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. It plays out in so many different ways. I'll give you one example. The one aspect that I want to look at is the liturgy of Kiddush Levana. The liturgy of Kiddush Levana is replete with this imagery of David and David's life and the symbol of David's life and the cycle of David's life. And so my plan for next week, we're going to do this in much more detail, is to look specifically at the impact of all of this on the bracha and choreography of Kiddush Levana. It's a fascinating story because I think there's no mitzvah in Jewish life and no liturgy in Jewish life that touches this issue more than Kiddush Levana does. I'll just give you one example of how Kiddush Levana relates to David HaMelech. So this is the source page for next week, but I just prepared it for now. I'll share with you a really interesting Maimar Chazal. Where did it go? It's in there somewhere. Oh, here we are. Story in Gemara Rosh Hashanah. Reb Chiya Chazya Lesihara. Davikoi Betzafru Desim Betisha. So you have to understand a little bit about Kiddush Levana. Kiddush Levana is a bracha that was designed to recognize the fact that we have to acknowledge the new moon each month. we do it through a bracha. In the time of Chazal, they had a mitzvah called Kiddush Levana Piri'iyah, meaning that they sanctified the new moon by having witnesses go out, look at the new moon, and when the new moon was spotted, they would come to the Beit Din and declare that day Rosh Chodesh. And that's the whole notion of a fixed calendar versus a dynamic calendar is built around this thing. So Rabbi Chiya was looking at the sky, and he saw the moon on the morning of the 29th. And the morning of the 29th is too early. So Shakal Kala Patakbe, so he took a clump of clay and he threw it into the sky and he said, Amma, Le'urta Be'inu L'Kedushibach, Vat Kayem Atacha, go hide, we need to be sanctify you tonight. You're too early, go away. Blot it out of the sky, covered it up, you're too early. So there's a whole discussion in the Gemara, in the Rishonim, what that means. They really didn't see the moon. They really saw a cloud. They wanted to push off Rosh Chodesh for a day. Right? Remember, the new moon can be arbitrarily determined by the Beit Din either on the 29th or on the 30th, based on the needs of the holidays. And so it's possible that they wanted to sanctify the new moon on the 30th, but on the morning of the 29th, it was already visible, and it was so clear that everybody would see it. So what was going to happen? They were afraid that people would begin to complain, that they would say the Beit Din is making it up. So, be that as it may, tonight we want to be Mekadesh you, tomorrow, and you're a day early. Zil, ichse, go, cover yourself up, says Reb Chiya to the moon. All right. Rebbe then said to Reb Chiya, Zil, le'ein tav, go up to a place called Ein Tav, I guess, which is a place where you had a good vantage point, Ayin Tov, where you could see well. V'kadesh le'yarcha, and go sanctify the new moon. And when it's done, Shalach li simana, send me a message, a sign, that you have successfully blessed acknowledged the new moon, acknowledged Rosh Chodesh, sanctified the month. When it's done, send me the following code. What's the code? David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. Which is, by the way, where this phrase comes from. And this is the source of that phrase. David Melech Yisrael is alive and well. So which Rashi explains, that David Melech Yisrael is alive and well means Nimshal Kalvana, that David is the symbol of, is symbolized by the moon. That David is represented in a Mashal like as the moon. As it says in Perek Tehillim, Perek Peitet, which is that Perek that we read 2 weeks ago, Kis'o Kashemesh Negdi, Kihareach Yikon Olam, his throne, like the sun before me, like the moon, shall be established for eternity. So in what way does David's throne, established like the moon for eternity, become a symbol of Kiddush Levana? So the moon is an odd, there's a difference between comparing something to the sun and comparing something to the moon. You compare something to the sun is there every day. You compare something to the moon's characteristic is that it cycles. Part of the month it's there, shining bright, and part of the month it's not shining so bright. In fact, sometimes it's even gone completely.
Does that mean it waxes and wanes like the Jewish people?
Exactly right. Right. This symbol of Ki Yareach Yikon Olam has two meanings. On the one hand, it's as fixed as the moon is. It's as firm and as permanent as the moon is. On the other hand, just like the moon cycles, it's possible that Malchut Yisrael, that the kingdom of Israel, cycles. Times that it waxes, times that it wanes, times that it's there, times that it's bright, times that it's even missing completely. Right?
So technically the moon's always there, it's just we don't always see it.
Correct, but that's a scientific answer and not a prophetic one, meaning the prophets are talking to what we see and not necessarily what the science behind it is. So in the symbol of the cycle of the moon lies the secret to the relationship between God and Israel and the secret to the relationship between God and David HaMelech. That, says the Gemara, is at the core of this issue. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim, David becomes the symbol for the mitzvah of Kiddush Levana, because Kiddush Levana is that moment when the moon recycles, when the moon reemerges. So send me a secret sign to the process of Kiddush Levana through this message, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim, which is why that pasuk enters into the liturgy specifically in the context of Kiddush Levana. So what I would like to do is explore this issue, or this example, in the story of David himself. The story of David's life, the story of David's descendants' life, and ultimately the liturgy of Kiddush Levana as an example of how this message is conveyed. I think it's really a very, it's a very powerful and very important one. There's a lot to be said for about it. I'm going to leave that for our discussion next week, but I kind of wanted to give you a glimpse of where this is, where I want to go with this. That'll be the last piece of our discussion on this parak. But this parak is a turning point. After this parak, the remaining chapters of Sefer Shmuel are a very different tone. You've got three chapters of David's wars, Chet, Tet, and Yud. Tet's not really his war, but it's connected. Chet, Tet, and Yud. And then you have David's Chet Batsheva, and you have the rebellion of the story of Amnon and Tamar, and the story of Avshalom, and the rebellion of Avshalom, and the David's exile and his return. The story changes dramatically from this point forward. This is one of the most pristine, pure, beautiful places in of David's life. So I kind of want to spend a little time on the implication of all of this. We've spent more shiur, I think, on this parak than we have in other on other stories, with the possible exception of David and Bathsheba coming up. But I really, it's David at his at his finest moment. So I think it's worthy to kind of sit and absorb that before we have to prepare ourselves for what's to come, which is the other half of David's life. All right. Any questions?
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure. My pleasure. My apologies for ending a few minutes early today, but I think this, at least we've finished this unit.
So we should now look at the moon with new respect.
Certainly at the mitzvah of Jewish moon dancing with new respect. We'll get to that next week. All
Thank
right.
you.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.